You are listening to the Frilla Bros Tech Podcast, episode 215, The Economics of Homemade Chips. Episode 215 of the Frilla Bros Tech Podcast. Today is November the 8th, 2015. I'm Matthew Dean Frilla, and trekking the stars of CBS is my brother James Frilla.
Okay, another cultural reference that I'm not staying on top of. What's going on?
It's Star Trek on CBS.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's a new Star Trek TV show.
I'm going to ask what's the premise, but I mean that deeper than Star Trek. Like, what situation do they find themselves in?
They haven't really said much yet. Basically, it's the same production team that did the movies. Presumably, okay. Star Wars on TV, kind of with the cast of Star Trek.
Gotcha. I said it right. I'm with you now.
Yeah. But the thing is, the biggest thing here is that I guess it's actually not just on TV, and by not just on TV, I mean not on TV at all. It is actually going to be on the internet primarily and only.
Really?
Yeah. So it's like they're trying to get their streaming TV stuff up and going. And so they're cool. So they're going to create a TV show specifically.
Is it free $3.99 or do they charge?
I think it's $9.99 for the per month. Yeah, well, everybody's realized that that's like where it's going, and so everybody wants you to get on that $9.99 a month because people are willing to spend it, which is just not true. We've already passed that point where you're just willing to sign up for any $9.99 a month service. Like, clearly I spend lots of money on dumb stuff, and I'm already like, there's lots that, no, I'm just never going to do that. And I think I got to believe that there's going to be a service provider, and I wonder if there's an easy way to do this on the back end, but where somebody gives you their credit card information, and they give you they give you all of your stuff, and you say, okay, well, basically, what we're going to do is, like, we're going to manage you. You pick what shows you want to watch, and like every month, we're going to change your subscription from one of these stations. So, like, you want CBS one month? Fine, we'll set you up on CBS, and we will cancel your subscription and resubscribe you to the new subscription automatically. It's just like one press of a button, and it'll be taken care of.
So, a highly specialized virtual assistant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can get behind that. How much would you charge for that little privilege? Just tack on an extra 10%. Buck.
Yeah, you said 10%.
Okay. All right, 10%.
So it'll cost you, if you're going HBO now, which is $15 a month, it'll cost you $1.50 that month. But all you do is you press a button, we'll cancel your subscription, and we'll bump you over to the new subscription. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be awesome if you could even queue it like you used to be able to with Netflix? Where you're like, this month I will be on this, next month switch me over to that. You know, you just get like
exactly.
A confirmatory email each time, like, hey, just want to double check. You sure you want to do this?
Yeah, exactly. We're canceling your subscription, but you'd put in one set of account credentials. You'd say, what do you want your password to be? What do you want your username to be? Give us it'll be your email. Because most of these things are email and password.
Right.
And all you do is you'd have a separate bank account. You'd take whatever your $11 out of their bank account, put it into your company's bank account, and then you'd pay everything out of your bank account. So that would be, and that way, like, so that way during those transitions where, like, if, you know, because Netflix will prorate it, but for, you know, services that or anything that prorates, yeah, this is. Why did we do this, James? We're doing this live on the air, man. This isn't actually a good idea. ugh. It's, you know what? I'm done talking about it. I'm not on the off chance that anybody's listening.
That's fair. So I'll quickly change it.
You're seeing, now that I've given the entire idea away.
Yeah. So I'm a little tired right now. And the reason is I participated for a couple hours in Extra Life. Have you heard of that?
No.
Yeah, so Extra Life is, it happened yesterday. And essentially everyone plays video games for 24 hours straight with the goal to raise money for something. You know, usually it's for like a children's hospital nearby, and they've got like a list that you can choose from. And so I had a friend who he and his kids were doing it, and they started at 7:30, let's see, Saturday morning, and went until 7:30 this morning. And they played every 24 hours, or, you know, they played the entire time for 24 hours. Pretty crazy. Wow. So I went and hung out with them for a couple hours between 2 and 4 in the morning. And, yeah, so far they're up to $6.3 million.
So, what, really? That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty cool. But, yeah, a fun little thing. So we're a day late. Sorry I missed it, everybody. But next year, we'll have a link in there, but it's extra life. It's extra-life.org is where it is. And, yeah, pretty fun.
That's very cool.
Benefiting the Children's Miracle Network Hospitals. So Dornbecker's is the one in Oregon that's part of that. But yeah, pretty fun little thing. And yeah, it was just 24 hours of gaming straight. So I walked in. They had a game, obviously, on the big screen. They had two other televisions set up. One, one for like a Super NES. One for like, they had a PlayStation going on one, the Xbox on the other. And then I and this guy's kid, we had two laptops, and we were playing Minecraft together.
Nice.
And, daughter had a handheld. Yeah, it was pretty crazy. Pretty fun.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So how does it raise money again?
You sign up to say, I want to participate, and then you give people a link, and people can donate. You know, it's one of those where it's like, hey, yeah, you're playing, here's donating, or for every hour you play, they'll donate some money or something like that.
Same principle as like running charities, I guess.
Yes.
If you're raising money for breast cancer.
Exactly. Yep. Totally how that works. But yeah, pretty fun little for gamers, you know? And I think it's not just video games. You know, if you want to do board games and that kind of stuff, that totally counts. And so, part of it. It makes me kind of want to get together a few dudes and, you know, that'd be a fun, like, crazy church thing to do.
That would be, yeah.
You know, where you're just like, 20 guys, we're doing this. Yeah.
24 hours.
There you go. That's, yeah.
Totally. Nice. I like it. Very cool. That was very cool.
So, a little tired, but I think I can make it.
Awesome. Well, I'm, you know, in that case, James, we got a lot to talk about today. So I say instead of giving away million-dollar ideas and raising millions of dollars for the people who need it.
And I didn't see Spectre, so we can't talk about
it. I know.
That.
I'm hoping I can see it this week. That's why I left it off the table. Yeah, me too. But I'm
looking for a babysitter. That's the one thing stopping us.
Bummer.
we watched Skyfall today, so we're like, and we watched, nice. So we're ready.
Preparado. Awesome. Cool. Well, this week, James, like every week, we'll be talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. And by that, we mean the soap opera of corporations, dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course, the technology they're developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a short disclosure he wants to throw our way.
Yes. I founded and work for Hewlett-Packard Inc., however, I do not represent, don't shake your head, do not represent HPI or any of HPI's opinions. I signed the founder's wall, so there you go.
That's how you know. Technically correct.
I also own part of Twitter and Etsy. It was actually a crazy party. I didn't get any work done on Monday. It was like just food and games and raffles literally all day. And then it all culminated in like a huge party that went until like 8 in the evening.
Whoa.
I mean, it was like free food, free drinks. They had games going on. I mean, it was like, they were like, no, this is a serious thing. We are literally a brand new company. It was pretty cool. Really? I think they, really, you know, they had that like opportunity to like send out the email, you know, and be like, hey, everyone, congratulations for helping us found. But no, they literally were like, no, this is a big deal. We're going to party. We're going to spend some of our new company's money on this. Which I think was appropriate.
We no longer got the dead weight of the enterprise, guys, and it's clear sailing on our backs of our printers. Let's do it.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. They all had us like to the main party area that we were going down a hallway, and they had all of the like the senior executives who were at my site. They were all there and like shook the hands of everybody, which was kind of fun. Yes. Like, oh, that's neat.
That's cool.
Yeah.
It's cool. My disclosure, so that you know where I'm biased to, I own a significant part of Facebook, Microsoft, Yahoo, Box, eBay, Twitter, Applied Materials, Skullcandy, Intel Corporation, PayPal, GoPro, and yeah, that's it. And by significant portion, I mean and share for the most material. Part. It's true. It's not nothing. I want these companies to do well. I'm shameless. Actually, the big thing is it's just so easy to buy stock on Robinhood.
It's awesome. And after that commercial, we will get on to
one day they'll pay us for it. Yeah, so if you want to follow us at the week, we do more stuff than just this on the internet. My Twitter is at Matthew D. Furlow. My Instagram is nextwiggin4, nextwiggin, and the number 4.
I am James Furlow at twitter.com, everywhere.
Nice.
Including Instagram.
If you want to know more about the show, we've got all sorts of clicks and links there, and everything that we talk about on the show is probably associated to some sort of an article that cropped up throughout the week, and we link all that stuff to the website. So any videos we talk about, any audio we talk about, or any written word that we talk about, it's all going to be there. Just go and check it out, furloughbros.com, tell a friend, email your grandmother, whatever you got to do, man, just spread the word.
Yeah, exactly. And hopefully you will take the time to do that. Oh, speaking of time. So, smartwatches are a thing, in case you missed that. However, old isn't the right way to say it. Mechanical classic timepieces are also still very popular.
Dumb watches.
And there are some out there that would like to have the best of both worlds. And a company that is making the Chronos Disc is attempting to help you have the best of both worlds.
Nice.
It's pretty cool. So it's a small metal disc that you attach to the undercarriage of your watch, and it like they said it had like micro suction. I don't know what that is, but it sounds cool. Essentially, it will stick. They're like it's like putting on a sticker, apparently.
Okay.
To the bottom of it, and you can peel it off and on. You know, not and it's like, but it feels secure while it's going on. So, anyways, it's this little disc thing that you put on the underside of your watch. It's waterproof. Like I said, it's got the micro suction. It has a few LEDs. It also has a vibration engine and a battery. And doesn't say it, but I'm guessing a Bluetooth LE to it.
Yeah.
So you can see where this is going, right? So you attach it, pair it to your phone, whatever. And so you can set it up so, you know, anytime you get a phone call or a text message, it can buzz or vibrate. And you can set up different vibrations for different apps or for different people. Your choice. You got some choices there. And you can even have it light up as an LED for notifications if you wanted, but you can turn that off. And because it has a sensor in there, you know, via either shaking of the wrist or tapping, you can tell it to do certain things as well. On a charge, after about a 3-hour charge, it lasts about 36 hours is how long it is. So, you know, so more than a day, which is good. And, yeah. Oh, and it syncs with the iOS health kit, and I'm guessing with Android stuff as well. So, you know, it gets all the data and shares all the data, and it has a nice little nifty app that you can use to also, you know, you can track. So it tracks all your health stuff too, right? Because it's got that, those sensors in it as well. Pretty cool little deal.
It's only a tenth of an inch thick. It's a pretty good idea on the power side, because I think where they're really getting a distinct advantage is Bluetooth LE is pretty low power. Vibration motors, they don't actuate very often, and the smaller they are, the easier they are to power. So I could see where, you know, you could get, because it's a tenth of an inch thick, so it only adds a little bit of thickness to your watch. Not too bad by any means. I could see where this is going, because especially because the power consumptive part on most smartwatches is the display. Like, that's where most of the energy is expended. And if you don't have that as a consideration, then, yeah. So does this do any health tracking? Does this do, like,
heart rate? Yeah, in the sense that... Ooh, heart rate. It tracks your steps.
Okay.
I don't know about that.
Hmm.
I'd be shocked if it did your heart rate.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. That's cool. You know, it's one of those things where, like, we're in a transitional phase, trying to figure out what the future of watches are and what that risk space looks like. And I bet they make some money during that period. How much does it cost?
Well, pre-order is $99, and then it'll retail for
$129. Well, you know, if you've got a $5,000 watch that you want to add some extra functionality to, it's not too bad, you know.
Right, and that's the idea. And yeah, exactly. Which, yeah, that's the idea.
That's cool.
I think it'd be kind of annoying just to get the buzz and not actually know what it is. You know, just know, I need to pull my watch out.
Yeah. Out
to see it. You know, but again, like you were saying, right? If you've already got a $5,000 watch that you like, and you. Like to dip your toe into the smart watch pool, here's a way to do it. Easy.
Yeah.
And they're saying setup and obviously installation, super, super easy, but pretty cool. So yeah, that's Kronos making some waves. Pre-order.
If I had to bet, I bet it doesn't change anything. And you might see one once in your life, but like I said, yeah, there'll probably be a couple of guys' career for the next couple of years, which is cool. Good resume builder. Be proud of them.
Just not they'll probably get snapped up by an actual smartwatch. Like, I could see, you know, one of the more established watch players saying, hey, we like what you guys are doing. What if we just put this in the watch? You know, not like a suction cup. That's what I could see happening. An acquihire.
Yeah, I agree. Tag, Huer gotcha. Completely agree. So, I actually read this interesting article that I'll probably drop a link in from The Atlantic. Be quiet, Siri. Go away. Sometimes she hears me say stuff that she shouldn't hear. So,
it happens. Yeah, because with your phone now, it doesn't have to be plugged in for the Hey Siri thing to work, huh?
Yeah. Hey Siri, how you doing? Of course, now that I actually say Hey Siri, it doesn't work. It only works. Yes. Yeah, it's whatever.
In theory, stupid. I'm with you.
The watch actually works pretty well. If you're looking at the watch and you say, Hey Siri, dictate this message for me, it usually gets it. But the whole Hey Siri thing is... Look, I don't use it. I don't feel like I need to use it. I've got enough hands to be able to hit the buttons. I use Hey Siri. I use Siri a lot, but the Hey Siri functionality is still lacking.
Fair enough.
Not quite sensitive enough. But so there's an interesting article in the Atlantic that acts as a good primer for this. I won't talk about it too much. but it's about the idea of programmers need to stop calling themselves engineers. Because they're not, by and large, is the argument that's being made in the article. They're the programmers, and engineering connotates something different. It tends to connotate a different level of sophistication, reliability. You know, we think of engineers as guys that build skyscrapers and bridges and automobiles and stuff like that. Stuff that people right. safety is dependent on, and there's a higher bar of performance that tends to go with what engineers do. Whereas a lot of programmers are just programmers. They're sort of this. They're not really classically trained engineers. I feel very good at saying this as a classically trained mechanical engineer working as an engineer and having gone through the licensing process, or at least part of it, and as I am a licensed engineer in training, and so I feel like, yeah, those programmers, super lame. They don't know anything. But there's this weird division that's coming out, and because there is definitely a distinct difference between different types of engineering and design work that goes along, and anybody that's in the industry will acknowledge that. And cars are a great analogy for what goes on in programming, because there are car engineers that work for like Ford, and they design and engineer cars, and there's quality engineers, and there's manufacturing engineers. There's all sorts of different engineers involved in the process of designing a car. And then there's guys that actually build cars and put cars together. And then once the cars are on the road, there are guys that work on cars, and they can repair cars, and they can fix cars. And there's guys that can sell cars, and there's this entire chain of people who work in the car auto industry that have very sophisticated understanding of how the car works that aren't actually engineers. And they are really, really important to the entire ecosystem of cars and that they keep working, and guys like mechanics. And that's sort of happening in programming too. And where do you get these, the mechanics of the programming world? And that is from boot camps, really, where a lot of guys that go into these boot camps, what they'll do is they'll learn certain types of, you know, you'll go in and maybe you'll learn a full stack of server-side software, front-end software. You'll learn JavaScript and PHP and Perl and whatever. You'll learn your different languages. You'll get pretty good at it. You'll be focused on it for quite a few months, high-intensity training. Come out, and get a job in the tech industry. It tends to be a very good-paying job, because there are very few that aren't. But the deal with it is, a lot of these jobs that you get afterwards are things like QA testing, where Apple, for example, they have the Apple.com website. They want to make sure that it works flawlessly on tons of different operating systems, tons of right. different browsers, and that there's no problems. And they want somebody who has a sophisticated understanding of how front ends and back ends are supposed to work, so that if you find a bug, you A, recognize that it's a bug, B, you have the correct terminology and, you know, frame of reference to write a good report saying this is what the bug is, so that the guys on the back end can actually reprogram it and fix it. And those guys sometimes aren't engineers in the classical sense either, because they're not actually designing the machine. They're maintaining the machine once it's up right. and running. And so there's all these different components of where does that come from? And there just aren't enough classically trained software engineers out there to really supply what we need on a digital level. So these boot camps have become really important to the whole ecosystem. There's tons of money being invested in them, and the DoD has actually stepped up and in something that is
cool. The Department of Defense?
No, sorry, the Department of Ed.
Okay.
Department of Defense.
DoD.
Department of Education. There we go. They've which is Department of DOE is the Department of Energy. So it's the, I believe it's the DOED is actually, anyways, okay. Acronyms aside, they have announced a program that's kind of keeping up with the whole changing culture of what does vocational school mean. And they have announced the plan Equip, EQUIP, but it's a new program allowing federal student loans to be accessible to students attending coding boot camps. Right now, one of the struggles with boot camps, because right now one of the big struggles with boot camps is that you either have to take out private loans or you have to pay for it in cash. And generally speaking, they're full-time things. So you quit, you go to this thing for 6 to 9 months, whatever the boot camp is, and it's like 12 grand. Like it is, and so you've got the opportunity cost of not having a job during that period because they're going to the boot camp full-time, plus the $12,000 that you're paying. So between housing, food, and this could easily bring you up into the ballpark of a $30,000 expenditure over that 6 to 9 months, depending on what you're doing. And
dude, that's crazy. How do they define boot? Is it like for programmers only?
I don't know.
Because like this could get insane quick. This could be huge. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like again, my favorite pet topic, right? Could I put together a real estate boot camp? Is that a thing?
I don't know.
You know what I mean?
Yes. I do know what you mean. Well, yeah, and part of this whole thing is that it's like the credentialing program, because traditionally one of the reasons why this has been such a hard thing is because federal student loans have only gone to accredited right. universities, like organizations that have gone through the whole process, and they don't tend to keep up with the rapid changes of the Valley. You know, they from their understanding of technology, they totally do, but evolving how you educate people, they don't, because it's something that's highly regulated and slow. So this is exciting because it's like kind of crazy. Let's just see what happens.
Yeah.
And people are like, so what are the standards? What does this mean? How much money can you loan? And what it'll inevitably mean is that these things, A, they go up in price, B, they make more money,
yep.
and C, yep. that means you're going to get more of them. Which
yeah.
is good.
No, that's a great thing. Hopefully less like of other degrees.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's exciting. I think we'll definitely.
Wow, that's genuinely huge. Now, okay, so is it actually passed, or is someone proposing it, or
no? They announced it.
This is a department, right? It's not a Congress thing.
Yeah, it's the federal bureaucracy. It's an executive branch thing. They are executing on their directive as defined by Congress and writing. Pretty cool.
Oh, dude, that's cool. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited to see what happens there.
I think that's huge.
I agree.
I know what my daughter's gonna do now.
Heck yeah. Well, it's cool because I mean we talk about on this show like every once in a while when I'm decided I want to be really depressing, I talk about how software eats the world and the oncoming automation and how do you stay ahead of that? What does that look like? And this sort of vocational
training, we're gonna talk about it later too.
Exactly, kind of. This sort of vocational training is gonna be really really important for people who have graduated high school or sometimes even graduated college but with a degree that when they started didn't require an understanding of how programming and how that particular type of machine works, and all of a sudden it becomes more and more critical to your job, not just as a how do I use a computer sort of stuff, but actually understanding how does the programming work, what's the idea behind the machine, and that becomes more and more valuable. So yeah, it's cool.
Yeah,
it's very cool.
See, and I'll be interested to see like again what the scope of that is, right? Because I could imagine a world where you don't do the 4-year university thing. You say, okay, I'm gonna do the, or maybe it's a 2-year, right? And you go 2 years, get the basics, whatever. Even though in theory that's what through 12th grade is supposed to do, right? And then what you say from there is like, I'm interested in doing X. I'm going to take a boot camp, get, funding, whatever, get a loan, whatever, however that works, to learn X. And then you go do it. And, 5 years later, you might be like, yeah, I've done that. It was fun. I'm ready to learn something new. You go to a new boot camp. It allows for genuine career change without a whole lot of risk involved, right? Because you're not going to spend years and years going to school. And that would be my daughter. She's not happy.
Yeah.
And but you know what I mean? Where it's like,
yeah.
you know, I know a lot of people where they decide, oh, I want to get into, you know, if they want to change careers, get into business, so they go get their MBA. And it's probably overkill for a lot of the jobs that people with an MBA have. But again, all depends on the scope, right? And probably same thing with the programming, you know, like you were talking about, where it's like, do you have to have the classically trained and learn everything? You know, some people should, don't get me wrong, but you know, there's a lot of people where it's like, no, do this boot camp, get really, really good at this one thing.
Yeah.
And save time and money.
Yeah, especially because right now it's kind of weird with like JavaScript. There's nobody learns vanilla JavaScript unless you're doing it as a just kind of a hobby. Everybody learns some sort of framework, and those frameworks can be ridiculously complicated yet extremely powerful. And one of the advantages of boot camps is they tend to focus on a handful of frameworks that can be used at different levels, and you can get really, really adept and be purpose trained for a company. You can get really good at Angular, right, and then go to Google and say, I'm great at Angular, and you know, I can maintain code, I can parse code, I can, you know, maybe I can't do optimization engineering, but I can, you know, go, oh yeah, this is where the problem is, and hand it off to somebody else who is, you know, trained in that kind of the higher computer science, computer engineering. Yeah. It's, you know, it's cool. It's important, I think. And also, it'll be, you know, as more and more companies build better and better websites, all of a sudden these guys are going to be really valuable there too, where you're not Google. You're not trying to deal with a million different hits every nanosecond. You're working with, you know, you're trying to handle, you know, 1,000 hits a day, and you just want it to be up and running and functional and look nice,
right.
And then all of a sudden you got somebody who you don't have all of the training of the computer science, but you're more than capable of building that, and oh, it's cool. I'm excited about it. I like it.
Yeah, I agree. That's definitely something that's exciting. Huh, very cool. I like it. All right, this next part here, we're just going to call it the Show Me the Money segment.
All right.
Yeah.
I like money.
Yeah.
This is the...
So we talked about one of them last week. Yeah. Apple had their Q3 earnings. They're amazing, whatever. Apparently, it's the death of them, though, however that works out. And everyone's like, jump the shark. Like, dude, really? Anyways, but they weren't the only ones who had quarterly endings. And so I want to talk about three of them that were highlighted this week. One of them, because they're the largest social network on the planet, and it's worth keeping tabs on the company that's keeping tabs on you.
And
then,
Google.
See how that works? Right. Then two of them, I thought this was actually really interesting here. So Etsy and Shopify. They both are in the sales arena, right? Etsy, which, full disclosure, I own, is, they sell handmade things. Shopify is really just like, it's a shopping cart, you know? And so it's like other third-party people implement their shopping cart. So here's what's interesting. So Etsy, they had revenue of $66 million.
That's a lot of millions.
But they had a loss per share of 6 cents. Okay.
What is that? Well,
they lost. Okay. If you were to take all of their shares, divide their, they didn't do the math for me, and I'm too lazy to look it up.
fair enough.
But so they lost 6 cents per share. Okay. Shopify had quarterly revenue of $53 million. Okay. So 13 million less, and also lost 6 cents per share. Okay?
Okay, I'm confused on this. So their price,
they're very similar, that's my point.
Okay, but the loss per share, I'm confused on this. How is that calculated? Is that minus their
profit? Okay, so you take your total amount of money that you lost, divide it by the total number of shares.
Okay, and so what you're saying is they made profits, but They didn't gross anything.
No, I'm saying they didn't. They lost money.
Right. So, okay. All right. Right. Revenue. So those profits. Right.
Okay. So revenue is like, forget about the costs. That's just the money that came into you.
Right.
That's, which I don't have a per share number for that because they don't give that.
All right. That's, I guess, it, because it was the units that was confusing me. And but it is basically they made $60 million. They were given $60 million, but they spent, let's say, $70 million, and of that $10 million divided by the number of shares would give you 6 cents, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. All right. Cool.
Yes.
All right.
All right. Sweet. So on the surface level, very similar, right?
Yes. Feels like it.
Okay. So what makes this interesting, though, and this is how the stock market works, so deal with it. Etsy went down by 8% after the news.
Makes sense. They lost money. They deserve it.
Yeah, yeah.
They should be punished.
And Shopify grew by 8%.
That's so weird.
Oh, I gotta love it. Yeah, but I mean, it's just like, oh, crazy stuff. Here's the deal. If you would like to know why.
Expectations.
All about expectations. Everyone thought that Shopify was only going to be earning $48 million, and they ended up earning $52 or $53. And so they were like, oh, you're amazingly better. I mean, you still lost money, and at their stage, it's kind of generally accepted that it's okay, which is weird all on its own. But yeah. The nature of a startup. Both of them, they got some revenue. Shopify, it seems like they're on the up and up. It also kind of matters on why you're losing the money. You know, is it from cash flow where, you know, is it on your income statement or is it because of cash flow type of stuff? And, you know, you know, if you're like Amazon, right? Oh, we're building a bunch of servers and investing in our business. We lost money. Okay, I don't feel so bad about that, you know?
Right.
Unlike, say, like RIM, where they're like, we just lost a ton of customers and we're just not making money. We can't afford to invest in anything worthwhile. Then you're like,
we have too many fixed costs and it costs more to operate those fixed costs than it produces. So we lost money.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's kind of how that works. So, so Etsy IPO'd at $30. It is now sitting at $9.21.
Ooh,
that I know. I am so upset about that. So upset because I bought it when it IPO'd. And at one time it was at $15, and I was like, oh man, should I get rid of it? No, it can't go down from here. So I don't know what's up with Etsy, man. They just are not delivering. And, you know, I remember like their big thing was it wasn't just that they sold creative stuff. They were big into the data analytics and tracking people and, you know, and really understanding their customers and what they wanted and making sure to funnel people to the right direction. But man, I'm like getting the sense that it's like Beanie Babies or something like that. They haven't, or mobile game developers, you know, where like they haven't figured out yet that it was just a fad and we're moving on. But it doesn't seem like homemade stuff is a fad. I feel like local is totally a thing. Amazon's getting into it, and maybe this is playing a role.
I was going to say, I get the feeling. I got a weird feeling about it. I got a weird feeling about it because I would say this. It's hard for me to tell because my lifestyle has changed quite a bit. I don't hang out with the same people where I just waste time and necessarily get to see them doing the whole Etsy thing all the time.
Waste time? I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, like just the people that I knew that were really big into like shopping on Etsy. I used to hang out around. I would hang out with people that were friends with them. And they would spend time on Etsy or talk about it, and I would find out, you know, through osmosis. Whereas nowadays, it's like I just don't spend as much time with that particular group, and so or when I do, I'm not hanging out in a capacity where Etsy would come up. So I can't tell if they're less into Etsy or if they're, you know, I don't know. It could be the MySpace thing where it's a genuinely good idea. It's just not. But it was a fad. It was the cool store for a while, and now it's sort of not as cool, you know, MySpace in it. Whereas somebody could come along and do it in such a fashion where it's more legitimate and it becomes a bigger platform and basically do what Facebook has done.
Yeah, pretty interesting.
I still hear people talk on the radio about how they don't understand how Facebook can be valued as much as they are. Like, they just don't. They sit there and they go,
we're going to talk about that in a little bit.
Are we?
Oh, yeah. That's my third company.
Okay. Well, then hit it.
Yeah, we'll get there. But before that, though, Shopify, good job, guys. Keep going. Facebook. Thank you. Facebook. It's crazy, man. They're large.
Yeah, they are.
Like, here's an example of how large they are. So they grew. I got to see if I can figure this out now. So in the United States, they grew like peanuts, okay?
Right.
So they went from, let's see, what am I looking at? Daily active users, okay? DAUs. This number's not going to work out for me. Like, some puny percent, okay? It was like 4%. Yeah, there we go. Facebook's monthly user count was up 4%, which they're like, that's really a lot, actually. Like, oh, okay. Which, to me, I'm like, wow, 4% doesn't sound huge, you know, and at one time they were probably growing at, you know, leaps and bounds, right?
Right.
So, up 4%, they were like this. That small little number in the U.S. and Canada equates to 4 million new users.
Sounds about right.
Which, by the way, they were like, and to put this in perspective, that's actually like, that's their largest quarter they've had in the last 2 years. So it's like, they're picking up steam again. Which is like,
in raw numbers,
Yeah, and so now they're like, it's one of those things now where Facebook is a thing, it has become a utility, and so they're like, new teens are joining, you know, they're in school, their friends have joined. Oh, I'm in, which is like the quarter that we just finished. And they're like, that's just now what you do, which they're like, you know, and everyone's talking about Facebook's dead. No one's joining, like evidence to the contrary.
Well, yeah,
they are growing huge. They're up to 1.55 billion people and their daily, daily active users is over a billion. So I think they were saying like that retention rate, or however, I don't know what they probably have a special term for that, is at 65% essentially. And which is like, that's pretty stinking good. I'm pretty sure Google's the only one who has a better number than them if they tracked it.
Yeah.
If Google had people signing up, you know what I mean?
Right.
But it's just like, it's crazy. It would be like, I would love to see this for other companies just to put it in perspective. And by the way, that's just Big Blue. That doesn't include the 900 million on WhatsApp, the 700 million using Messenger, and the 400 million on Instagram.
That's the part that
always gets me. Which I do understand there's probably like, it's overlap. Probably a lot of overlap, especially on Messenger. But
Me about those numbers, and because they're talking about how they're now averaging over a billion users per day. They've put 1.5 billion, and those numbers were calculated without third party apps and platforms that were accessing Facebook numbers. Where when they crossed the billion user threshold, they actually included third party platforms that were using their APIs and stuff. And they're like, now they're like, no, this is legit. This is Facebook properties.
Yeah, which on Facebook.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're like, holy cow, this is huge. Those are huge numbers. And the thing that gets me what I want to focus on, and the reason why I bring this up is because I hear really smart people that are really well tuned into just kind of what's going on in the world, whether it's politics or economics or stuff, talk about Facebook like it's MySpace. Like it's a fad. Like it is something that like the company could just disappear overnight. And like you sit there and you go, there is this weird effect, like you said, the Facebook effect of it's a utility. There is something that is irreplaceable about it. And the company is very aware of what could come in and knock them off of that platform, and they fight it. They know what is at risk, and that's why they buy things like WhatsApp and Instagram, and you know, they go and they take over these other platforms that could threaten the dominance of the big blue app. And they are very successfully countering that by, you know, Borg assimilating those things and then optimizing them and improving them and making them better and making them more robust. And what's crazy to me is that what's really cool and encouraging about the company too is its platforms like Parse, like Instagram, like WhatsApp, all of the engineers that I've ever read or talked to who work on any one of those three projects, they always say the best part about joining Facebook, the best part about becoming part of that whole collective was not feeling like you were being assimilated. Parse doesn't run on Facebook servers. It runs on Amazon web services. They use the AWS suite for their back end. You're like, but it's a Facebook company, and Facebook has more servers than Amazon. Why would you do that? And they're like, well, we built everything for the Amazon Web Services, and we didn't want to disrupt it. And Mark was like, yeah, fine. Make it great. And like, that's amazing. Like, that's so cool that they're letting you do that. Instagram, another great example. You know, there's definitely cross-pollination, and they use the Facebook servers because the delivery of content and the distribution of content, there were huge improvements that came along with that. But it's a completely different code base than Facebook. In some ways, it competes with Facebook, and especially for engineering talent in the company, they're like no, it's a different thing. And when a new engineer comes onto the premises, and as Facebook hires engineers, they don't hire they hire to the company. They don't hire to projects. And so if you come in as an engineer, you get to get further recruited by either Instagram or the big blue app. And so they have to compete for the talent within the company like that. Yeah. And you just like, they really treat these things as separate things. And the reason why that's important is because if one of them fails, the other ones will survive. The other ones will thrive. And they're very good at picking platforms that have potential and giving them a really safe place to grow. And it's a lot of like what's going on with Oculus. Oculus had a lot of potential, but there were a lot of potential downfalls along the way too. And most of them were associated with somebody else beats us because they got more money and they can just outspend us. And once they had kind of proven themselves as a reliable technology, this thing performs well, there's an actual potential there, we've got the engineering talent to put it together, we just need the money, then Facebook said, cool, don't worry about it. and for the most part, have left them alone, just made sure they hit the finances to roll out a large manufacturing production line. Oh, it's just, I like that company.
And by the way, and just for, you know, for the Wall Street part that they care about, Facebook earned $4.5 billion.
It's a lot of bees.
Not as much as Inc. And their earnings per share, that same number.
James, it's not about your level; it's about your trajectory.
yeah, right. I was gonna say, I probably shouldn't say that too loud because I'll have to eat that in a little bit here. Wow. Because Facebook's doing well, not because anything HP's doing. I just want to be clear because of the trajectory, like we were talking about. Anyways, the earnings per share was 57 cents. They actually do break out with that. If they were to look at just like your net income, so again, you get rid of all of the investing that they're doing, their profit was a little under $900 million. Or for those of you who'd like to do the math, that's a 20% profit margin.
Pretty good.
Pretty good. And honestly, that's one of those that probably just goes, that ratio just gets better the bigger they get because of the nature of how their system works. Kind of like Google, which was somewhere around like $11 billion last time. And they're, you know, it just skyrockets each time. It's kind of a crazy company. No, they're kicking butt, taking names. They're now 11 years old and they seem to be doing just fine.
I didn't know this, but I'm taller than Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, I believe he's a shorty.
It's 5'7". I mean, he's not short. He's just...
No, that's above, short. Let's be honest.
Average. Yeah, that's pretty short. That's short. You're short, Mark.
That's pretty short.
Look, I don't got much going for me when it comes to competition, but if reach is it, I'm sticking with it, man.
I was on YouTube today. Might have been yesterday. And one of the recommended videos was, this is the best scene from The Social Network. And it was the scene where they reveal, I know the dude is Spider-Man now. I don't even know what his Moskowitz or something, whatever. Anyways, the dude who was suing Mark in the movie, like, they reveal how his share got diluted and how everyone else just didn't. And they were like, boom. And then it showed that scene where they're asking him to go in and sign the paperwork. And Zuckerberg's like, dude, you made a bad business decision. And like, he goes, it's not my fault that you are bad at business, essentially, and signed up for something that, you know, you shouldn't have. And yeah, pretty interesting. I was like, it's a powerful, powerful little moment there.
Yeah.
Zuck's probably just like, I wish that movie would go away.
Yeah.
For the most part, it has.
I can say. Yeah, I get the feeling that he will be remembered. It's like Steve Jobs and Steve Ballmer. You got to crack a few eggs to get where you get, but not Ballmer, Gates. Bill Gates,
yeah,
Steve Jobs, where you get these bad reputations that people that know you, and once you're kind of established, you go, oh, okay, that was kind of pretty rough, and I think you soften a lot.
Well, you just sit there and go, it's like, that was his Snapchat moment, you know? Yeah. Just, it was a punk, stupid kid, and probably today, honestly, it was, would look back at it and be like, man, that was, yeah, it was pretty jerk on my part.
Didn't need to do that. It was, you know, it was an unforced error,
yeah,
as the word goes. Ooh, but he,
I like that term.
Thank you. Yeah. But I'm taller than him.
There you go. That's the end of the Show Me the Money segment.
Woo! I think that's the definition of ad hominem attacks. Like, I like Zuckerberg. I think he's pretty good at what he does. I like his company. But if I'm feeling a little insecure, I can just bring up the fact that, oh yeah, I'm taller than you. Right for the body shot.
I'm just waiting for you to like meet him in person, and like, and you bring your hand up and he brings his hand out to shake your hand, and yours just keeps going to the top of your head, and you just do a little measure.
Scoreboard and walk away.
A little back and forth. And you just, yeah, that'd be awesome. What if you didn't even say anything, right? You just do that and then just nod your head and move on.
And be like, what the heck was that?
Oh, man.
Good times. Okay. Oh, man. I don't even.
Let's talk about that other big company that's just raking in the bucks.
Woo-hoo!
But, you know, because one of the nice parts about being huge and having the margins like Facebook and, you know, like Google is you can do fun stuff, you know? And so that's the next part, right? We want to talk about Google and...
That was a much better transition than I was going to be able to come up with. So Walt Mossberg, a fan favorite on this show.
Moss Puppet, it's my favorite over him.
What?
Walt Moss Puppet, he's hilarious.
What is that?
Some dude made a puppet that looks like Walt Mossberg.
Is it like a YouTube thing?
Just makes fun of him. It's pretty funny.
I'll have to check it out. He does
reviews. As Walt Moss Puppet, very angry little puppet.
Oh my gosh, that sounds awesome. So on Wednesday, Walt Mossberg wrote an article where he said, it's time for Google to make their own hardware, basically arguing the fact that so the Nexus 6 came out and snaps in half pretty easy. And
yeah, I heard about that. Some dude just did it with his bare hands.
Just broke it. He's like, I think he attacks it correctly. He goes, his whole stance is, it's a great phone. It's a little bit fragile. So And just keep that in mind. That's not, you know,
fragile.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and he looked like he was trying pretty hard to break it. So under normal use, it's not going to break.
That's right. He works for The Verge now, doesn't he? I forgot about that.
But so under normal use, it doesn't. But Walt Mossberg, he basically came around and said, look, you guys are a big company. I know you've kind of messed around with hardware before and your partners didn't like it, but Microsoft's doing it. Apple's doing it. Everybody's doing it. And if you're going to keep doing this whole, what was it called? The whole Nexus thing where where you're building, because the whole idea of the Nexus program was they build a first in class device. This is optimized Android. This is pure Android put onto a piece of hardware specifically designed to run it. And so just give this is the best of the best, and not necessarily they wouldn't go out there and try to dominate sales or anything. It just is their way of saying this is ideal Android from Google's perspective. And the deal was they didn't want to build their hardware themselves, so they would partner with companies like HTC, who they would work very closely with, designing the hardware, optimizing the software, and they would come out with these devices and they would put them on the market, and you'd be able to buy them directly and unsubsidized and go through different carriers and kind of just get the whole Google experience. And he argued that, hey, if you're going to keep doing this, it's time to get serious and build it yourself and really own it, because there are deficiencies that come along with doing what you're doing. It's not turning out as the way that you want it to. You're not getting the quality. You're not getting the performance. It's not ideal Android.
And I've got to imagine, like, had this war been going on 20 years ago, let's say, like, Apple, Microsoft, clearly Microsoft could get away with it at the time.
Yeah.
And it was okay, but for whatever reason, phones are just a little bit different, you know, where it requires just my door is magically opening.
I know. It's weird.
It's because my dog's feeling better and walking around when he shouldn't be.
He's
a troublemaker. Anyways, you know, but given today, for whatever reason, the phones seem to be a little bit more complicated and a little more integrated, maybe. I don't know. And it seems to make a difference. And I mean, and clearly Microsoft has gotten that message too.
You know what I think the answer is? I think what has really happened is engineers have embraced the idea of that vertical integration of software and hardware, that there are things where it's just an entire principle of how do you build computers. And there's a class of engineers that have grown up and have become very talented at it. And there's always been this idea of it's always been demonstrably true. If you control the whole stack, you can do more. But it requires a certain set of skill and planning that I just don't think was around in the 80s when Microsoft was really going gangbusters. And so there's more of an idea of we just let anybody do whatever they want, and we let the free market just sort of, you know, the destructive.
Well, it was all about let's make it general and work on everything. And that was
exactly
the philosophy.
But there were clearly losses. There have always been inefficiencies involved with that. And now they're saying, now we're good enough.
Honest, Apple wasn't great at the time.
It's true. Yeah.
Integrating to the level that they should have. Could have.
Exactly. And so what you end up with is this world where, yeah, like you said, I think it just, I don't think it was as practical as it was back then. Now it is more practical, and Google should get on it and build something awesome, is what he was basically saying on Wednesday. And I get a feeling that Mark had a little birdie tweeting in his ear on the couple of days before Wednesday, because I know for me.
Who did?
Mossberg.
You said Mark.
Mark, sorry. I meant it's a Facebook Freudian slip.
I was like, is Facebook doing something with Android? Finally?
No, Mossberg. I think somebody was talking to Mossberg, and I can say this because. It wasn't the best kept secret in the valley, I guess is a fair way to put it. But Google wants to build their own chips, and part of this collective idea is they want to get into silicon production. And once again, this is something that Apple has really done great, and it is led it to a huge benefit by designing their own chipsets along with everything else that they're doing, whether it's getting the RAM designed by firms in Israel or working with, actually, I guess it wasn't RAM. They were having their memory chips getting designed. You know, they get stuff specifically designed for them. They have a team that designs their processors that works with the Taiwanese Semiconductor and with Samsung. They're clearly in talks with Intel to have Intel do manufacturing of their chips. There's a lot going on right now that is allowing Apple to build really great hardware and software. And the thing that goes along with that is Apple consistently has benchmarks that outperform everybody else in the market, despite the fact that their hardware technically performs worse. And in your normal spec wars, it's got less RAM, it's got fewer cores, it has a slower clock speed. It really shouldn't do better if all things were equal, but they're not, because Apple does hardware acceleration, and a lot of it for their specific software that they want to have it run well. And it allows them to do some really cool things and get some really great performance that nobody else can compete with. Or at least to compete with it, you got to get these crazy octa-core NVIDIA chips and really optimize the software for it. And so that's what Google wants to do. So there's a couple of different areas that they want to go with this. One of them is just straight up processors. Google and the other part of this, and they honestly didn't reveal very much about what it looks, so this is kind of speculative. But there's three major categories of chips that they can be looking at. One is getting even deeper into building chips for their server farms. Right now they use Intel chips, but Intel works with them pretty closely, where if they want some hardware integrated stuff, they go, we need these functionalities, we want that to be emphasized. Intel listens to them. They listen to them today like they used to listen to Microsoft back in the 90s. And the reason for that is Facebook and Google are the two biggest independent chip buyers of Intel chips. So they've got enough influence. I don't see them wanting to build their own chips necessarily for a bunch of servers, but there definitely is something there. Google builds a tremendous amount of very well-kept secret technology for their server farms, a lot of hardware acceleration, really specialized stuff that years ago we talked about the Pluto routers. They showed up one day and nobody had any idea what they were. They thought they were probably government technology, something from the NSA. Turned out they were the Pluto switches were Google technology, and nobody had any idea what it was. Still to this day, they don't really know what it was or how it works, because it had like proprietary plugs and stuff. Like, what is this? It doesn't make any sense. But that's the sort of thing that Google does. So that's one area. The next area is cell phones. They might be wanting to be getting into doing what Apple's doing, specifically with cell phones, where they go, we want to build something highly integrated, very fast, works with Android, get rid of some of the middle layers that have been slowing down their system and allow it to perform at even higher rates. I actually think that that's less... I think they have interest in that, but I don't think that's going to be their main purpose, because between Qualcomm and NVIDIA, they've got some of really impressive chipsets. So unless they're building chips specifically designed for their software, and they're going to do some integration and they're going to be competing against Qualcomm and against NVIDIA and against Samsung and against all these different companies that are building really high performance chips designed to run Android. I don't know. It's hard for me to believe that Google is going to be able to come in there and really beat them down, but I think they're interested in it. I think it's a space they want to get into. After reading all this week, I definitely think where their biggest emphasis is going to be is competing with Microsoft's HoloLens chipsets.
You think so?
Yeah.
Google?
I think Google wants to do that. And so this is the logic behind it.
Yeah, walk me through this. I did not see you saying that.
Yes. So the logic behind it is this. When Microsoft came out with the Kinect, it was all software integrated, and it didn't work particularly great. It had a lot of potential. There was a lot of excitement. And then when they came out with the Kinect 2 and the Xbox One, it performed a lot better. And one of the big reasons for that was they did a lot of hardware acceleration that allowed them to do the different depth sensing that they wanted to do, higher resolutions, better performance. And Microsoft started to come out with all these different APIs that were built into it that allowed you to do much better modeling and spatial understanding using the Kinect. And that whole project was in parallel with what was going on behind the scenes with the HoloLens team. The HoloLens team have talked about before that the idea that where a lot of your VR stuff is basically the sensing units, your accelerometers, your gyroscopes, those are built into the headgear. But the actual image processing stuff is done outside of the headset on your PlayStation 4, on your computer, whatever is going to be driving the VR set. With the HoloLens, they wanted to be able to get rid of the computer completely. Now, there might be a computer doing some of the processing, and they might be sharing the load, you know. But for the most part, they wanted to do the image processing and the spatial recognition in the hardware. So they do have hardware-accelerated chips, basically, that are specifically designed to do on-the-fly, super-fast image processing and come up with a spatial area and spatial understanding. And that is what is they're accrediting the success of a HoloLens 2. That really is where their performance is showing up, and they're seeing it perform better than anything else. Google, I think, looks at that as something that there's nobody else doing it right now. That is really, Apple actually bought the company that helped Microsoft design their first chips for the Kinect 1. Apple bought them, but hasn't done anything with it. Presumably, they're, you know, doing the Apple thing of, we'll get around to it in 7 years. Microsoft making very big public show of what they're doing and what they're capable of. And I think Google's looking at it as the next wave. You know, obviously, they wanted to get out there early with the whole Google Glass thing. They thought that was a big area. I think they're looking at the success of Google Cardboard, and just developers are clamoring for it. They're watching what's going on with the Oculus and PlayStation VR, and they're sitting there saying, there's a there. That's going to be a big area of performance, and if we can get on that as the next level, that'd be huge. And then the other part of this has to do, and the other reason why I'm theorizing this, is because this last week, they also announced the winners of the Project Tango competition. They gave out...
What was that again?
So the Project Tango was this Johnny Lee. And I don't know if you remember this demo that he did years ago. Probably should link it in the to the furloughbros.com. I got the words out. But he used the hardware of a Wii...
I remember that.
Head tracking, and he could do motion tracking and stuff. Well, he got hired by Google X Labs and to do motion tracking stuff, and he led the team that came up with what was called Project Tango. It's this cell phone, basically. It's a thick cell phone with like 7 cameras in it. And the idea was they wanted to use that and say, can we do good spatial tracking and modeling in real time with a handheld device if it has hardware dedicated for that purpose? And as they were, and they came up with the answer, yes, they refined it and they came up with the next generation, which was the Tango tablet that you can actually buy development kits for through Google. And a bunch of people bought development kits, and they came out with all sorts of different apps that they said, these are, you know, if you win, we'll make a big deal out of you and we'll show off everything that it can do. And it's really, really pretty awesome. gets me so excited. But it's the whole idea is it's kind of an augmented reality system. And instead of using a lot of your traditional motion tracking where the platform, the Lighthouse platform that Valve has come up with for head tracking or for spatial tracking, they have cameras set all around the room that will track where you are in real time. Oculus, they're doing something similar. There's a camera that's going to be tracking the headset, so you can do spatial tracking of the headset that way. Whereas with Google or Google's Project Tango, it's going the way of the HoloLens, which is, now we're going to put the cameras on the device, and then the cameras on the device will do spatial tracking. And from there, since we've got cameras, we can either do augmented reality or we can do full virtual reality. And I recommend you go and watch this video because it's awesome, where they show off the different technologies that you can see, whether it's augmented reality and they're like people playing in a space together, or you're seeing them do, you know, shooter games where there's stuff coming out of the walls. A lot of the same similar demos is what you would see with the HoloLens. You know, it is a different technology because you're looking at a screen as opposed to looking through a something that's going to add it. You know, HoloLens is additive, whereas whereas Tango is not. It's completely, you know, it's an LED screen that would replicate the real world and then project on top of it, or completely replace it depending on what you're using it for. But there's other demos that they do beyond just games, where they're like, where one of the really awesome ones is, it's a system where you can like scan things in real time and just walk around and scan and build models that you can import into things like Autodesk and SolidWorks to use those models and have actual 3D models of things that you just filmed. Because you can build the depth maps, you can build take all those analytics and actually recreate this thing with textures in 3D in real time, which is pretty incredible what they're able to do. So there's a lot of potential there. And the goal of Project Tango, and what they've talked about, is they said, we want to figure out what the minimum requirement for hardware is to be able to get this, you know, what's the minimum amount of hardware that we need? What is our minimal viable product so that we can then go and say install it on every Nexus phone? Because once it's in everybody's hand, sort of like the gyroscope, sort of like the compass, sort of like the accelerometer, sort of like the touchscreen, sort of like all these different technologies, once it becomes this foundational technology that every phone has, then all of a sudden it just opens up a wide world of potential new devices. And I sit there and I go, if you look at how well the HoloLens performs, you look at what they're doing with the Project Tango and what their goals are on that, this is a perfect marrying of those two ideas. Let's do hardware accelerated image processing specifically for getting real-time 3D spatial contextual information. And that is going to perform and improve everything that they're doing with Google VR. It's going to potentially change what you do with, you know, GoPro. I don't know. I just sit there and I go, to me, I think this is what they're really looking for.
Wow. That is...
Oh, and cars. Don't forget cars. Don't forget how much that would help cars.
Self-driving cars. That's true.
Spatially aware self-driving cars.
Which leads right into our next topic too. All right.
I was gonna catch my breath and let you comment before I jumped into the cars.
Yeah, that was quite the interesting. Okay. I could definitely see where, you know, Google's headed in that direction, and I could see that that's exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just so clear that it's still in the infancy, and there are going to be a ton of different uses for it. And there isn't just going to be, I don't want to say the classic virtual reality, but that's kind of how I want to say it. You know, there's going to just be so much more than that. And it's understanding where you are, not just relative to the device, you know?
Yeah.
It's like the gyroscope tells you the orientation of the device. The other sensors tell you where you are in space, and, you know, starting to marry that up. I don't know. It's pretty cool.
To me, I sit there and I go, it's a pretty clever idea in that it sort of says, what's the best performing visual systems in the world that we've ever seen? Well, really and truly, there's two. There's touch, feel, and there's eyesight. You know, we're not talking to, and the thing with eyesight is that it's passive. It absorbs light and then processes it. Whereas touching goes out and feels it. There's not a lot of systems out there. There's not a lot of organisms out there that have been very successful by sending out a signal and receiving that information back, with the exception of, you know, bats. There are very few organisms that use some form of reflective sensing. Most of it is passive sensing. And I sit there and I go, it makes sense for them to sit there and go, maybe we should take a hint. It's a good idea. And I think, to me, I'm obviously very excited about the PlayStation 4 stuff. That's probably what I'm going to get. I'm ready for it. I've got my different systems all set up.
Yeah.
Very excited. And turns out, by the way, I was reading an article, I'm not the only one. That is going to be the killer. I think 2016, Christmas time, people are going to like it. But the deal there is that it's kind of a dead-end technology. Where that idea of putting cameras around you and then having them be aware of you, there are just limitations to it that are completely just leapfrogged over. They're not even acknowledged when you look at the Magic Leap stuff that subsidiary that they have and the Project Tango stuff. You know, those two companies, they're not dealing with external hardware figuring out where you are. It's about figuring out where everything else is around you.
Yeah.
You know? And it's what the cars do too.
Right. That's cool, man.
Mm-hmm.
We shall see.
We shall see. I'm very excited. But speaking of cars, so this goes further into my theory. Google came out this week and said fully autonomous cars are hard, but so is getting people to pay attention to cars that can do most of the rest of driving. And basically, they've been asked, you know, look at what Tesla's doing. It's really awesome. Why not come out with something like that? Why not help evolve towards autonomous cars? Why not do assisted driving? Why not just make it really smart cruise control? And Google sat there and said,
yeah, why not, right? Let's just do that.
Yeah, come on. And Google basically was like, they came back and said, look, we've looked into this, and in our opinion, it's ridiculously hard to get people to pay attention once the car does most of it for you. And it's important for people to pay attention. And Google has talked about, when they talk about accidents, there's three categories of accidents, right? There's somebody hits the car. It was a fault of the other driver. Couldn't be avoided. The next problem is the car is driving itself and it crashes itself. And then the third problem is the driver takes over and causes an accident. And where it's technically the Google car's fault, but it was the driver that was driving. And Google has never had a Google car get in an accident on the roads where the car was driving itself. It's always been because somebody else hits it or the driver takes over and hits somebody. And I think in Google's opinion, they just sit there and they go, man, this is going to be tough because there's such a temptation where if it can do most of it for you, that you just won't even pay attention. And the liability, the whole point of what Tesla's trying to get across is, look, the liability's on you. Like, you need to be responsible. You need to be paying attention. And videos over the last couple of weeks on YouTube of people like reading the newspaper or hands off and just trying to get the car to do something dumb and get itself into trouble and then let it take over. And so far there's been no horrific accidents on YouTube, and actually they've even come out and said, you know, we've only seen examples of the Tesla cars.
Wait, who's done this?
Like owners
of Teslas?
Of Tesla cars, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you have a $100,000 car moving at 40 miles per hour under its own direction, and you just you know, take your hands up, Tesla, take the wheel, and just let it see what happens. It's just craziness. Makes for a good wow. YouTube video, though. Yeah. And Tesla's, understandably, they're like, I guess Elon Musk was. He basically came out and was like, look, we can't, we're not going to let them do this. This is craziness. This is not going to work for us.
So they're going to undo it?
Well, they're going to put more restrictions on it. Like, one of the things is it requires, like, they want your hands to be on the steering wheel.
See, and that's the kind of stuff you don't know until you do it, you know?
Yeah.
You want your hands to be on the steering wheel, huh?
Yeah. But that's why Google has decided that their next generation of cars don't have steering wheels. Because they've set that
in. Whatever, dude. The videos will be up for a week, maybe a month, and then they'll be like, okay, whatever, it is what it is.
Yeah. Just write it out. Just
let the car ride it out.
Take over. It's fine. Trust the car. Yeah, it's an interesting dilemma that they're having and an argument between the two companies of what's the right way to go forward from here.
Yeah. I'm in Tesla's camp still. I mean, it's inevitable that we're getting to fully autonomous cars, but you will learn so much by doing the incremental approach as well. And I think there's, you know, there are governmental and regulatory concerns that need to be addressed as well. You know, Tesla found a nice little loophole this week.
Yes, right? They did. This is pretty exciting. Turns out pretty much every millimeter of your cars are regulated. When they go through safety testing and they go through performance testing, and the federal government makes sure that your car is going to be, you know, obviously nobody's perfect, but they do test it to make sure that it's safe and reliable. Except it turns out that there's no regulation of software updates, especially over the air software updates.
I know. Do they get in trouble for this, or can they just not get in trouble for
it's
it?
It's just not illegal. I mean, sometimes we forget that we you know, the whole idea of the land of the free was that things are only made illegal. They're not, you know, when we talk about something being made legal, it's you're uncriminalizing it. They're doing something that the government has never criminalized. So it's just legal to do. And one of the big reasons for it is because a lot of these over-the-air software type things were sort of, they were oriented towards, like, media centers, where it's like your radio or your navigational software, not, you know, your GPS, turn on this road. That's how it all is kind of, they're like, yeah, whatever, that doesn't have anything to do with the car. But Teslas are so highly automated and they got like so much computer technology in them that's all in the same thing now. it's the same box. So they just are sneaking in automating their cars under the same rules that, or lack of rules that govern changing your radio station.
So amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. And that's I would have loved to have been in that meeting where, like, the executive asked you, like, are we covered on all the regulatory stuff? And they're just like, actually, there's nothing.
Yeah.
We're good. And it just like, I could just imagine, like, there just being kind of silence on that phone for a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like, no, that can't be. Go look into it. Go talk to somebody.
Yeah, go talk to a lawyer.
You know, yeah. Or, like, go talk to whatever department's in charge of, Department of Transportation or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, and then just, like, in a lawn, you know, just kind of like, I would have loved to have been in that meeting where he's like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You can't do that. Like, actually, we can.
Yeah. Autonomous cars are like this big deal, and everybody's like freaking out. Like, should this be legal? Like, what are we going to do about it? Like, what's the future of this stuff? And they've got all sorts of crazy licensing things and
state it's weird. We're normally some sort of blanket, like, can't do anything without it being checked.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And normally, and then you get into trouble where it's like, well, yeah, that made sense for the physical world, but now it doesn't for the digital world, and we're, you know, artificially restricted. And this is like the opposite. We just forgot to say anything about it.
Yeah.
That's the whole, like, I shouldn't be too surprised, right? Where, what is it? Google is required to have the side view, the mirrors, right?
Yeah. But
not the steering wheel.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, they're just like, it's kind of funny, right? I mean, these, it's like, clearly whoever was making those rules, you know, set the initial set for the car rules, like, they just made a ton of assumptions, you know? And
yeah, those practical assumptions.
It must be like the car manufacturers must have been amazing lobbyists at the time. And like, we're just starting to realize how amazing they were. Because they were like, no, we got them to do very specific things and exclude other things. And therefore, like, you know what I mean? They didn't let them ever do a blanket. Everything's covered. It had to be very specific and spelled out for everything. Like, yeah, we know. We did that on purpose. It's, yeah. GM, you're welcome.
Yeah.
You know what exactly. I mean? I mean, like, this has to be what's going on here. And now these guys, you know, these old dudes, all these lobbyists, they were like, oh, that was our idea. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they're taking advantage of what we did. And, you know what I mean? I just, like...
Well, and it's one of those things where it goes back to that whole software eating the world thing, where it takes a computer scientist to say, where you ask that question of, it's funny, you bring up the scenario as though it's like, they go, so what regulatory stuff are we going to need to do this? And then somebody would come back and say, actually, there's nothing overlooking it. It's possible that the conversation went the other way, where they went, gosh, I wish there was a way to do this where we could, like, we could put everything in place, and then in such a way that the regulators don't really look at it, and then we just, like, pull the trigger later. Like, you get an add-on for the cameras or something, and then somebody was sat there and went, well, we can always just add the software later. Like, what? You know?
Yeah. And I wonder, too, like, how long has Tesla been sitting on this knowledge of the loophole? You know, because,
well, you know, honestly,
they didn't start this like 6 months ago.
I think that's part of it. Is I think what they realized was that they've been sitting on this I don't think they've just been sitting on it. I think that they understood exactly what the implications of it were, and they've been taking advantage of it for years and updating software and making tweaks and increasing performance. Because how often do you hear about, like, they added ludicrous speed or whatever, you know, and you're like, oh, cool, that sounds good. But nobody really, like, thought about the idea that, yeah, they could just add autonomous driving to the vehicles without actually having that go through anything regulatory. That's just a software update. And there's, like, a limit. There is a limit to how far they can go before it is a fully autonomous car. But there's a big gap between, you know, between currently what's legal, which is, cruise control, which doesn't require your foot to be on the gas pedal or anything, versus, you know, fully driving cars.
Yeah, I know, which, again, comes back to my idea of, like, that's why I'm in Tesla's camp. You know, you start pushing it. And, yeah, you got stupid YouTube videos, and Tesla should send out an email to them, you know, to owners, being like, guys, it's a privilege. Don't abuse it. Otherwise, we're going to get clamped down. Stop posting stupid videos on YouTube. You know what I mean? Like, I honestly, if I were Tesla, that would be some sort of email that I would send out. I would probably say it a little bit nicer than that. You know, but she's like, guys, you're representing our company here, and we're trying to change the world. Let's act a little responsibly here.
Yeah.
And... yeah, that's what I would do, because that's literally what they're doing. And I think they're going to do it. And again, Tesla is now getting, I'm guessing, though it's probably not a guess, a lot more data about what's happening with their cars than Google is, just because they have a larger sample now.
Exactly.
And it's real world. It's not just in the Bay Area and Mountain View. You know, it's everywhere. And they're just going to start to learn a ton that... yeah, don't get me wrong, Google engineers are smart, and they've put a ton of miles on the road. Do you know how fast, I'm going to go with this pun, Tesla's going to lap them? I don't know. Tesla's in a position where they can do it, right? And Google's not. They kind of don't have a choice, you know, because they're not a car company.
Right. Right. And yeah, like you said, I mean, in this world, data is king, because you can learn an awful lot awfully quickly from all of this. And it's valuable. It's really valuable. And
this is one of the reasons why Apple will probably make an amazing car that I will not want to drive initially, because it won't have any data, because they're especially not going to, they're not going to be doing monthly reports like Google does, telling everybody, hey, here's what we're doing, here's what we've learned, whatever. They're not going to do that. And they won't have nearly as much driving data. And you need people out there doing stupid things in your car. So you can go, stop that?
Finding the edge cases, as it's sometimes referred to. Speaking of Apple disclosing, popping the secrecy bubble, they rarely ever do it, but they only ever do it when they absolutely have to. And it turns out they absolutely had to earlier this week when they announced that they filed paperwork with the city of San Jose. For those of you who don't live here, there's an airport like right in the middle of, so San Jose is south of San Francisco. Just go to Google Maps and follow along. It's south of San Francisco, but there's like a small airport like right in the middle of it, right in the middle of like two freeways that bisect it. The 101, as the SoCalers call it, is above the airport. So right above that, they are buying up a bunch of land, buying up a bunch of office buildings, and they just filed with the city of San Jose a petition saying, we'd like to build something there. And they did specify how big it's going to be. And
did they?
Yeah. At least gave it a ballpark, but turns out this thing, whatever it is that they want to build, it is going to be bigger than the spaceship. It could be up to 4.15 million square feet. By comparison, the Apple II campus, the spaceship, is going to be 2.8 million square feet. So almost twice as big as...
Third.
Come on. Just James. James, let him...
Okay.
Take
a big
off,
almost.
Take off
almost.
Your, take off your
Sorry for doing math.
I was gonna say. No.
I'm not an engineer, I guess.
We're journalists right now, okay?
Oh.
Talk shows.
That's right. Come Entertainment with, purposes only. Math may not be accurate.
Yeah. So exactly. So they're building something big. They want to build something big, huge, in the middle of San Jose. And nobody really knows what it is. And everybody's very tight-lipped. But the rumor...
People are tight-lipped, then no one really knows.
It's true. The rumor is that they want to build a car factory.
Car factory.
Which isn't crazy, because Tesla's...
It'd be the first time they built a manufacturing place in the U.S.
It's true. And Tesla has their entire factory, like, literally a 15-minute drive from there. So it's not crazy, the idea of setting up a...
This is like when Kodak set up a new headquarter, a new site across the street from HP that does all their inkjet photo work, and then suddenly magically started hiring all of HP's people.
Exactly. Yeah. A lot of your electric car guys work here. Faraday Future, I think, is the company's name. They just announced that they're going to be building an electric car to compete with Tesla, and they're setting up shop in the Bay Area. And right now, the claim is that they're being backed by some billionaire Chinese guy. The rumor is that it's actually Apple. I don't believe that at all. But
I just I hope that it's like autonomous flying vehicles. there's a part of me that thinks that would be easier, and it would definitely be cooler. That's for sure. I think that's the rumor that I'm going to start going with. It's autonomous vehicles, but they fly. Autonomous flying vehicles. So they need that space, you know? I just like, just get ahead of everybody. And that's Apple, right? Yeah, everyone else was making smartphones. They had buttons and whatever. And we went, forget the buttons. And so, they're just like, forget the roads. We don't need roads.
Where we're going.
I can see it. I mean, they'll be missing some sort of really key feature that actually helps you drive successfully.
Yeah.
But it will fly.
Wheels.
Yeah. Like,
it's a car. Oh, yeah. It flies. But can I drive it? No, it's a car that flies. But that'd be really useful if it had wheels. Yeah, but...
Wait till version 2.0. Yeah, exactly. Apple Car 2. Or we'll wait until Apple Car 8 just to really make sure you have to keep buying them.
Yeah.
Cut and paste. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, right.
But when they do it, man, those wheels, they will hum like other. These are the best wheels out there.
We were going to, you know, everybody else had added wheels, but we thought they had done a really terrible job. This is the first time anybody's ever done wheels right.
Yeah. Exactly. Made with a rubber polymer.
Yeah, exactly.
Multiple colors. That it's designed to withstand all sorts of weather and whateverness. No more need to change your tires in the winter, which that means nothing to you.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really mean anything to me either. This website does not want to load. That's kind of annoying.
Yeah, so I don't know.
Just do it by memory. Yeah. Oh, great. Now everything's blacked out. Fantastic.
Who
Thanks, Google.
What a joke.
Okay, so I'm going to do this semi-blind here. Let me quickly pull it up on my phone. So one of the things we're talking about with all this is artificial intelligence.
It is.
Right? That definitely is playing a role in everything. I'm so annoyed that this browser... Oh, well. I find that I only get so much use out of Google Docs. And then partway through the show, which, what are we? We're an hour and a half into it-ish.
Oh.
It suddenly stops working, where anytime that I click on another link to try to open it, it hoses everything. So, like, right now, I closed out the browser, you know, just that instance of it, reopened it. I was able to open up Google Docs just fine, and I can see my list. Now, the moment I click on another link, both pages will just go blank.
What?
And then I have to shut it down and restart. Yeah, super annoying. So I got my list back on my computer, and then I'll just have to open these files up on my phone. I wish I had an iPad. That'd be really convenient right now. Oh, well. Okay, so artificial intelligence was what I wanted to talk about. And so a couple things. It's, as we have just talked about, it's totally happening, right? And now there are a couple concerns with them. And one of them, he writes an article called An Inconvenient Proof. And he makes some very heavy religious analogies. There we go. Metaphors to go with it. And, you know, just saying that, like, it's kind of interesting, actually. He went to school to become a minister and, like, wanted to and studied the New Testament a whole bunch with the whole goal was to, like, to prove to himself and to his friends that, you know, Christ was the Son of God. And he's like, and scientifically, there's a great deal of validation for the historicity of many of the books of the New Testament. But in the same way, I might want to introduce two good friends to each other in hopes they might fall in love. I've come to realize I can't force the decision for someone to believe in God. It's up to them. And so he then goes into free will, and which is kind of this idea of an inconvenient proof, and saying that the issue with a bunch of the AI stuff is that essentially it takes away people's free will, right? It makes the decision for you. And, you know, and just saying that, you know, there are all sorts of problems with this. Number one, they're made by people who already have biases in them because they are, you know, human driven. And, and so it's like, so you got that to go with. And so you have stuff where it's like, you know, you might have someone where they're making the bias to drive safe over to drive fast.
Right.
You know, we could make the argument whether or not that's a good or bad bias, but it's a bias nonetheless, right? They have biased these cars to follow the law. And,
right.
And that's like a, you know, that's one where I'm pretty sure all of us will go, okay, that's a good bias. I'm glad that they have that one.
I prefer that.
But there might be other ones where it's like, ah, oh, you know what? Maybe that isn't quite as, you know, not as black and white of a bias that needs to be made. And so, you know, he's saying that, you know, there are some problems with that. It's like, and like one of the big biases that people have is like, like when it comes to the marketing, he's like, there's absolutely no marketing funnel that ends in abstinence. That's like, they go, so this is the part of the funnel where we leave them alone and we don't do anything. It's like, no, that it's always pushing people towards action, pushing them in some direction. You know, that's the nature of it. And so he's just talking about how, yeah, if you, you know, like with autonomous vehicles, or we're going to talk about education in a little bit here, you just got to be very careful about, like, okay, what am I giving up here, and what am I being pushed into, and, you know, what's, am I losing any of my, like, of my own free will, or even my own, like, beliefs, you know, based on where I've been slowly pushed all of these, you know, all these years. The other thing that he also says is, like, so that's, like, takeaway number one. And then takeaway number two is that a lot of these things, these, like, AI programs, they take away one, like, major component of humanity, which is surprise and spontaneity. He's like, that's, like, one of the things, which, don't get me wrong, can sometimes cause a ton of trouble. but that's also one of our, you know, great strengths as well, is we do stuff where you're like, that made no sense. Why did you do that? That was awesome. You know what I mean? Yeah. And you discover stuff as a result of it. And so he's saying, like, there's also a great risk of, you know, of just losing something as a result of all of this AI stuff that's going on. And I think I'm making a reach here to try to pull these things together, but there, I don't know if you know this, but the college and, well, the school textbook is dying. I don't know if you knew that. At least in college, right?
You had printed paper, so, you know.
Yeah. Well. Even the digital ones, the digital static ones, are dying, and they're being replaced by artificially intelligent modes of learning, and they're like, and I actually thought this was the most interesting. So, like, one of them is called ALEX, which is an acronym for something about learning really well, and ALEX is actually, you know, this is what's interesting about it is what is it? McGraw-Hill acquired them and bought them. And McGraw-Hill describes themselves now as a, what is it? It's an education technology company. They're like, they're divesting in books. They're like, you know, like, it's dying in the sense of, yeah, books are not as good, but, like, the companies that make the books aren't making books anymore. And so, like, so we won't really have much of a choice where they're investing in these AI things, and they're like, and the value proposition is so much better, where it's, okay, not only are you going to get a course that is designed specifically to you at your pace and your interests, but you're also going to, you know, they're like, the problem with textbooks is you buy one and then you put it on Amazon for sale and someone can buy it used,
right?
And textbook sellers hate it. And so what do? To compensate for that lost revenue, they increase the price of the textbook.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Right? And that, like, perpetuates the cycle. So, like, the cool part about the software stuff is you're just paying for an annual license. And because software is so cheap to do, you know, the marginal cost of that next person, they're like, they can charge you $25 per person, per license.
Right.
They're like, cost you less, and they actually make more money because they're not trying to deliver textbooks and track down whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you get a genuinely better product. They were talking about this one classroom where the kids are all sitting in front of computers working. It was a pre-algebra or algebra class, and the kids were working through their stuff, and, like, there was no talking. The teacher never did a lecture. She was just a walk-around tutor, like we've heard, and, you know, like we've talked about, like, this is the future. It's like, no, it's the today. It's just rolling out slowly. And they're like, and it's kind of cool where it's, they have a minimum number of things that the kids need to be proficient at. And if they are going faster than a minimum, it then has a whole bunch of related electives that they can go even deeper on if they want to. And it's got enough content to keep them interested and keep them going. And the teacher can, you know, has charts and graphs, and it's like, oh, everyone, this set of kids here, they seem to be struggling with the same concept. Okay, I'm not going to pull them out and do a specific lesson with them. And like I said, the teacher becomes a tutor. And again, they're like, yeah, teachers may be upset that, you know, their job's going to be taken away from them, even though, like, they are still educating, and they're just, they're helping the individual kids, and the class sizes are still probably going to remain the same, so it's not like jobs are going to disappear. Like, but again, the book publishers are the ones who are making the transition. Right. You literally will not have a choice unless you want to hold on to old textbooks near future.
I don't know if I've ever talked about this on the show before, but it kind of is an extension of it. It's one of my favorite tech thought experiments. And it's this idea of, so right now we've got Google Translate, right? Where you can pick up your phone and you scan a picture of like a sign in a foreign language. And I think they've got like 10 different languages that they can do right now, from Spanish to Chinese, all sorts of different stuff. But the idea is you scan a Spanish sign, and in real time, it translates that sign to English. And so you can read the English and go, oh, okay, now I can read the sign. It's really cool technology, yeah, okay. Very super high science fiction. Well, one of the things that I've always liked is, okay, you Google a lot of stuff. They learn a lot about you, and you use a lot of language with Google. And so they can build up sort of a repertoire of knowledge of what your language level is at. What's your vocabulary? What are the things that you understand? What areas do you have a strong vocabulary? What areas do you have a weak vocabulary? Where is your spelling strong? Where is your spelling weak? They can build a profile of you as a language speaker. And they also have the technology to be able to take a picture of what you see and overlay on it. Now, let's say we get to the place where we have Google glasses on all the time, and it's constantly scanning all around us looking for that information. And they have an individualized profile for you and your language. So let's take it to the next step and not say they don't necessarily translate from Spanish to English, but maybe English to your level of English. So let's say you have a smaller vocabulary, you have a smaller, you know, smaller understanding of what goes on. And so when you read stuff, they actually break down into simpler words and something that's more digestible. So it's easier for you to read. And then Google decides to take it upon themselves as sort of this, like, hey, we can do something here. And every once in a while, they pepper into those translations more difficult words. More, you know, more advanced language, more full language, and they can evolve and help you learn just through natural language experience a bigger, more robust vocabulary. But then they can take it even one step further, because if they can downgrade the language, now there's no theoretical reason why they couldn't upgrade your language and say, well, you're already strong, but we want to take you to the next level. Or let's get crazy. Let's just every once in a while drop a Spanish word in there so that you can slowly start to transition to a new language, where we'll just change one verb. We'll change one noun, we'll change a few verbs, a few nouns, things that we know you know and that you understand, and we can slowly evolve you that way. Then we get to this really weird question. This is an easy hypothetical to understand. Then we get to this really weird place. If you can translate any language into any language, even within the language to different levels and different dialects, who gets to decide what direction you go? Google already makes that decision for you in a lot of ways based on what you search and what information they return. They're making that decision, and it's a profit-driven one. They want to do something. They want to give you the best, what you're most likely to like.
Right.
But there does become this place where, what if they decide to do something more than that? What if they decide that this is what people like? How do we actually determine what language is? And then you sort of have this sort of blurring effect where there's no codified language outside of your dictionaries. But even within the dictionaries evolve because languages evolve organically. What if there's a giant AI behind this whole thing that's sort of trying to figure out how to get us all to talk to each other better and can be translating speeches, can be translating interpersonal conversations from language to language or within languages. And, you know, and I come, it's the same question. Who gets to decide what this content is? Who gets to decide what's, who's learning what? How is this all driven? And we are more and more, a lot of this is what are we interfacing with? What is between us and what we're learning and the information we want? Right now it's Google or a textbook or an artificial learning technology, but those end up being your gatekeepers. And there is, like, there are TED Talks where they talk about the whole, you know, this sort of narrowing of what we see because they focus results to what we want, and they don't necessarily venture out into the world of, you know, if you tend to be very liberal and you always click on liberal links, that's what they're going to start returning to you exclusively, and you actually get these curated results that don't have anything to do with what you're necessarily interested in. And then actually, I did add a video. I don't want to talk about it too much. I recommend you go watch it. It's made by what's it called? Computerphile is the channel, and it's pretty interesting and sort of talks even more about this and asks the question of, what about Asimov's three laws of robotics, the idea of kind of morality for robots and, you know, to keeping people safe, do no harm to people, do what people ask you to do unless it conflicts with the first one. And then the last one is keep yourself alive unless it conflicts with the first two. And he spends like 5 minutes just really sort of asking the question, why is the first one so difficult to accomplish? These sort of moral questions. And sometimes we ask these questions and they're just completely superfluous to the engineers that are actually building them, because they're like, that's a ridiculous question. Because first we have to like define these things in a way, like, we're just trying to scratch the surface of this stuff. Let us get, like, that is a million years from now before we're even to the point where we can ask the question of how would we deal with codifying these types of questions.
Well, that's the point of iRobot, right? The machine interprets it differently than we think it should.
Exactly. So it's...
Spoiler alert.
I know, sorry about that.
Feature of our show. It's all good.
But it's it's definitely, I would click, if you go to furloughbros.com, click on that video. It's pretty interesting, just to kind of as a capstone to this whole conversation. Yeah.
Okay.
Focusing on a little more real world current stuff, getting a little less heady. So Apple seems to have done something that was uncharacteristically Apple. The Apple TV, from, I've read a lot of reviews. I haven't gotten one yet. I probably will, because I want to program on it. But the Apple TV, so far, like, the reviews right now, they're basically, like, usually if it's a new category of device, they're like, it's awful, who would ever need this? Like, it's pretty nice, but totally pointless. That was what they said about the iPhones.
About
the Apple Watch, the iPad. And then, you know, you get a couple generations in, and everybody's like, it's kind of amazing, but if you have last generation stuff, it's not a necessary upgrade. If you've got two generations to go, upgrade. It's pretty good. Like, those are like your two categories of responses. And then occasionally you'll have a bend gate or an antenna gate, a single pain point that people are complaining about. Apple TV, not like that. Basic review of the Apple TV is, like, it's got a lot of potential, really rough around the edges. And I think my favorite description that somebody gave to it is, it's got more rough edges than a bag full of saw blades. Just a pretty good analogy.
Okay.
But they just overlooked a couple of really obvious things, like the App Store.
That's what they do.
I know. Well, but I mean, no. This is worse. The App Store. They launched new hardware. They gave the hardware to developers early so they could build apps. I mean, they sent out tons of them. They really tried to get developers on board. And then the App Store, no search function, no discovery function, no top charts functions. Yeah, they just have the one main splash page that, well, I guess it has a search function. But there's no, like, discovery mechanism like the App Store
just
has.
Relax.
Well, but yes, okay, you're right. That's just one problem. But, like, developers are freaking out because they're like, you asked us to rush this development stuff, and then you don't give users your normal way to discover things? What the heck is going on, Apple?
Yeah, that's fair.
Then there's things like the lack of Apple Music through Siri support. It has Siri. It has Apple Music. It just doesn't have Siri Apple Music. Yeah. Which you're like, okay. And they're like, Apple's
and like, I feel like Siri's been doing this since the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. You've been able to play music.
That's forever. Like the number one way I use Siri. Shuffle yeah. this playlist.
Exactly. Exactly. And it just doesn't, it's funny. It was the first thing I tried without even thinking about it. And it didn't, and was like, sorry, I can't do that. What? one of the ones that, Mac Daily News keeps whining about.
Every single article, whether it has to do with Apple TV or not.
Is the whole, the Apple TV remote doesn't work, which that's my primary way of interacting with my Apple TV is the Apple TV remote, just because it's way more functional. Number one, because it's got a digital keyboard that you can just type in. It uses the iPhone keyboard, so it's really easy to work with, as opposed to like trying to select.
Well, and I've heard like the new one's even worse than the old one. Yeah, the old one used to be like letters in a grid, and you have to search around. Now they're like, no, they're all just in one big line, and you literally have to scroll back and forth to do it. And everyone's like, it's miserable. Especially when you're required to sign in to every one of these apps with your username and password.
Right.
You're like, it's the most horrifying experience ever. And yeah, people are like, I've heard that. They're like, this is bad. And sounds pretty bad.
What weirds me out about it is it's still getting like the end review of everybody's like, it's pretty awesome. Like, there's real potential.
See, again, dude, this is a classic Apple, right? They focused on like, what are those core things that will differentiate us and make people like, yeah, this is pretty good. And then what will give us a reason to do an update next year? And well, you just like, this is, and again, this is why I will not buy the first version of an Apple car. Well, I probably won't, period, because it'd be new and I don't buy new cars. But if I did, I still wouldn't buy it because it's going to have these kind of issues. And you know, maybe they'll push out an update as fast as they do with the watch. You know, that was a pretty quick turnaround.
Yeah,
but I've got to imagine, you know, that's going to be their, like, they need that kind of feedback. And they just, like, they totally miss that stuff until they work on the things that they think are cool.
Yeah.
And that's what they do. And then they get the feedback. And then the manager's like, okay, we got to do these things now. Right? Yeah. I mean, like, that's totally their MO. I don't actually know how it works within there, but that's the sense that I get. And yeah, that's whatever.
It's funny.
They know it. They're working on it. It's not Apple. It's not the promise they make, right? Like this thing will work amazing and be smooth. And they've thought of those little details where you're like, oh, that's cool. You know, but again, they worked on the fun things. Apparently their screensavers are amazing. The little flyover photo things. People are like, this is so cool. That was a fun project. So they did that.
Yeah.
Instead of literally like finding the piece of code that does the Siri music thing and putting that in. They're like, it's lame. It's already been done. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Right? That was like, we've done copy and paste on the Mac. What's the big deal?
Yeah. Who needs that? Yeah. Yeah. They're wackadoo sometimes. I'm still excited about the device.
This is why Google fanboys like love to bash on Apple. They just they do make it pretty easy sometimes.
Yeah, just giant target on your back. Like, come on,
why not?
How do you miss that? But
if I had a TV, I'd want one still.
I know. Me too. I'll probably get one before they fix everything and be like whining about it on the show. Like, the keyboards.
But, yeah, well, you know. And then I'll update, and you're like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
That's how that works.
Yeah. Speaking of things that you don't expect coming from companies, so Amazon opened a bookstore this week. Like,
yeah, that's a little weird.
Not an online one. Not a digital bookstore. I already had one of those. Decided to open an actual bookstore. And nobody's quite sure why. one of my favorite parts about it is somebody actually went to it and they're like, I gave it a 2.5 stars.
Nice.
sort of a lackluster review. They're like, yeah, as far as bookstores go, it's not great. It's not a great bookstore by any means. I have two theories on.
It's literally just a bookstore.
Yeah.
Huh.
They use
Amazon. That's a little weird.
It is really weird. They use like Amazon stuff. It's all Amazon data to try to figure out what books go best. But yeah, opening up a bookstore. And, you know, they
is there a coffee shop inside of it?
It's got to be. It's in the middle of Seattle. If there's not.
I feel like. Yeah. Does Amazon say why they're doing it?
No. That's part of what is. Let's see here. Katty has already visited Amazon Books opening morning, as had some of her staff. They spoke about it with exaggerated grimaces, more dismissive than unnerved. The selection is not bad, Katty emphasized. Indeed, the store carries books by some prominent independent publishers. Coffee House Press. Well, that's not a coffee. Talk to me about coffee. No, that's the only mention of coffee in the entire article. It's Seattle. If they don't have coffee, how do you not do that? That's weird. It's kind of weird. I have two theories. One theory.
Yeah, okay.
One theory is that it's kind of one of their weird experiment pet project things. Somebody thought it would be cool, and they decided to, yeah, we got enough money. Let's try it out. Let's see what happens.
Someone wanted to make a phone, so they tried that, and now someone wants to open a bookstore, so like, sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Got money to burn.
Exactly. This is fine. Amazon Web Services is doing great. We can keep this going.
Yeah, we're good.
my other theory, and I'm gonna be.
Maybe that's it. They want to get experience. They can build out their small business tools.
Exactly. This one's a little bit out there. I don't have any proof. I'm the only one that I've heard say this, but I wonder if they're looking at Apple and Microsoft and the Apple stores and the Microsoft stores, and like, we want to have a physical location to sell hardware and stuff because that's really advantageous. Just getting it out there, set up the perfect environment for it so it shows off the best and it drives sales. But they don't want to come at it as like a copycat Apple Microsoft store because they have the Kindles and stuff.
Well, if that's the case, they're very successful at it.
Yeah, exactly. Because they've gone way out of their way to be like, no, this is a bookstore, not an electronics hardware store. Like, they're there. You can go and pick them up and stuff. But I wonder if it's a Trojan horse sort of thing. And I wonder if that's part of the theory. I don't know. It's so weird. It's so weird. I can't tell what's going on. Maybe they've got some data about, like, no, bookstores are resurgent, man. They're coming back. You know, honestly, by volume, we're selling more books than ever.
Huh?
You know, maybe there's bigger business there than you'd think. And
yeah, I guess I'm just trying to figure out what value they can add to it. I mean, I guess like the Amazon self-publishing stuff, maybe, plus their hardware and services.
That's why I keep coming back to. I get the feeling that this is a Trojan horse, and maybe I'm wrong in thinking it's a Trojan horse for Microsoft and Apple, but it's a Trojan horse against Walmart. You know, what did they do? The first thing that they built was a bookstore online, and then they turned it into an everything store online. Maybe this is their first, like, they want to open up retail space. They recognize what Walmart...
But again, why? I don't... It's... What do they gain from that?
Well, so... I think
I mean, if it's all about, like, faster shipping, you know, just open up smaller distribution centers everywhere.
Well, but see, that is the reason why Best Buy and Walmart are surviving against Amazon, because they treat their stores as small shipping distribution for everything. Like, we've talked about this before. They are...
Well, yeah, but Amazon could do that without the storefront.
But there's an advantage to the storefront in that you come in and you use it as just a store. It's just you walk around and say, yeah, these look nice. And then you order it online and it shows up at your house.
Yes.
I mean, I
think that'd be such small incremental revenue relative to what they're doing online, but maybe not. Maybe they know something I don't.
Why are they building a bookstore?
I don't know.
It doesn't make any sense.
I don't think they know either.
Yeah,
it's like, okay, they don't know why they built a phone.
Yeah.
You know, they had like one or two features they thought were cool, and for some reason they didn't think that just licensing it out to an Android manufacturer.
Yeah.
Like, that was the answer. Come on, guys. In that particular case, do like Google and partner with a different hardware company to do it. I don't know, man. It's
Amazon,
dude. They do weird stuff. They bought a newspaper, right? Or Bezos did, so clearly he's into old school stuff.
I know. That's kind of weird. He's
well, I guess we'll see. You want to take bets on how long it takes before it closes? They're not afraid to shutter things. They, you know, their phones,
true,
right? We're not selling these anymore. Yeah. Turns out it was a bad idea.
Yeah. Which is good. I mean, it's better than sticking with a bad
idea. Let's
see
here. 2 years sounds like way too long. Okay,
it is middle of Seattle. It's the hometown boys selling books in the middle of Seattle. I mean, that sounds weirdly promising just on its just having lived there, knowing the culture. Of course, they don't drink Starbucks.
Okay, so there's two ways, right? There's close it down and then expand to other locations.
Yeah.
Or at least have the strategy become kind of clear. One of the two. Three. Care to at least take a what direction you think it? I mean, I'm willing to say definitely no expansion happening. If it's still around in like 2 years, it's just that one store. And honestly, it's mostly they haven't got around to closing it yet. It's now it's a figurehead, you know?
Okay, so this would be my guess.
That's my pessimistic guess.
I think Amazon wants to get into opening storefronts. I do.
Okay.
I don't think it's going to be all bookstores. I think this is their first step into a larger strategy. If this particular one stays open or not, I think depends entirely on its performance. My guess is going to be that it stays around for a year or two at least, and they use it as a learning store before they expand it not to other bookstores but to other Amazon stores, physical locations.
Now, for the record, I would actually be probably fairly supportive if Amazon filled the gap that Radio Shack left.
That's, we've talked about that before. There are a bunch of Radio Shack stores that are open that Radio Shack still owns, and they're trying to find a buyer for all of those locations. And that would be,
yeah, I could see Amazon doing it and doing similar items. But again, it's, you know, Amazon fulfillment and all that kind of fun stuff, plus a bunch of other content to help people actually become into the makerspace. They could even do the AWS and all the tools and have, you know, workshops and classes on here's how to, you know, integrate Raspberry Pi with our services. Here's how to use the dash button for whatever stuff. I could see that, you know, that would be pretty cool. I don't get the bookstore, but a Radio Shack type thing I could get behind.
Yeah. Bunch of odd ducks over there.
Yeah. And like our earlier conversation, they're making enough money like some of the others where they can afford to try stuff out, right? They can be surprising.
Yeah.
And do things that are not logical. And every once in a while, you get lucky and actually find something that works really well as a result of it. So in that sense, I can get behind it.
Yeah.
Full circle. Should just wrap it up right there.
But we're not,
we're not going to, because there's one more out there that we haven't really touched on. We've given them a pass, but no more. So Microsoft hates you. Just wanted to put that out there. Actually, that's not true. So they've got their OneDrive storage, and they had an unlimited plan, and some other fairly good ones. Well, not anymore. Their unlimited one is now limited considerably and to like a terabyte. And their other tiers have all been lowered dramatically. Now, their best tier, which is only like $7 a month for a terabyte, pretty darn good. Everything else, not anywhere near as competitive as the others anymore. And apparently, they had a few abusers on the unlimited were like, they're like, yeah, we had more than a few users who were storing over 25 terabytes worth of data.
Holy cow.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of data.
I was like, so that was your answer. Just let's just cap everybody and lose out on this unlimited thing, you know, branding, which they were probably finding that it was only people who were, you know, buying a ton of ridiculous space. It's one of those where it's like, again, it's got to be tough being in Microsoft's spot, right? Where they thought they could do it. Like Tesla, they got taken advantage of, and yeah. Their customers were being idiots. And then they're like, okay, let's rethink this. Didn't see that coming. Turns out not everyone's rational. And, you know, so I get why they're doing it, and it probably wasn't an easy decision. And in the long run, it will probably be good, and it will blow over. But it's like, man, you just sometimes hard to catch a break.
But, yeah.
You know, they're still doing good things. So I think their heart's in the right place, given all their other more recent activities. But just pretty funny. Just be like, sorry, guys. We thought we could give this to you for free. And again, it's like right on the heels of like everyone else pretty much being like, okay, we're either A, expanding how much you get, or and or lowering our costs. Oftentimes a combination of the two.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, or just, yeah. So yeah. Just like, well, oh, well. It's okay. Like I said, I think it'll be good in the long run. And I think, too, this is just one of the symptoms of a company that's getting into the monthly subscription. They're like, no, we actually need to make money on this. We can't have loss leaders. And
right.
Because this is kind of like our thing now. So I get it. It's just kind of funny. So we'll see.
Good job, Microsoft.
It's okay. I can deal with it. All right, dude. That's our show.
Oh, I like it.
So I write down my note here. Microsoft and OneDrive. All right, man. That's how it works. All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us. And thank you so much for listening to episode 215. Pretty crazy, right? Man, we really do appreciate it. So don't forget to check out all the show notes with all the links and that video at furloughbros.com. Again, this is episode 215. If you'd like to get the show notes sent directly to you every single week, you can sign up on that same page down at the bottom. Now, for the record, if you remember from last week, we kind of talked about a special episode airing on Friday. It turns out it's this Friday. We just had some reasons to bump it another week. But trust me, it's happening this Friday. And so if you do
it's
go...
It's recorded. We have it ready to go.
Yeah, we're ready to go now. And so if you want to get that show sent to you, just sign up at the bottom of the page and it'll be there. It's easy. Name, email. That's how that works. So again, thank you so much for listening. We totally do appreciate it. I am James Furlough. My... I don't remember at all.
I can't remember. I can't do the Star Trek theme.
Was that what it was?
Yeah.
Yes, there we go. My my non-vocal Trekkie brother, apparently, is Matthew Furlough. And we will talk next time.